Session number 15433.
Peter McAleish, side 9. Could you just go over that again, so that we may got it on tape?
Yeah.
You said you're not in. I'm not into this sort of thing. Can you just repeat that?
Yeah. I'm not into sort of. I've never felt I should be in a position to court martial MD.
Yeah.
So as I say at the end of it, rather than pronouncing sentence, I went up and spoke to Sammy personally.
Mm.
And. So as we're taking him outside, holding Roberto started.
And you said to him,
yes, we're going to shoot you.
Yeah. And he said,
get on with it.
Right.
As we were walking outside, we got a firing squad. I mean, guys were actually fighting to get on the firing squad,
Really?
Aye. Because Sammy had, bullied a few of them and whatnot, and they were shit scared of him.
How old was he?
Sammy, I think 26.
Yeah. And
27.
What rank had he been?
He'd been a Cop 1-3 part.
Yeah.
And another
and
class.
Why had he left? Had he got?
No. Sammy just came out of the army. He just came out.
So what were you going to say?
You broke my train of thought.
I do beg your pardon.
So we went outside and holding Roberto started in a big re thing. He says right. And Sammy was standing there, and the firing squad was lined up in the hole and says, we've got to, handle this, political wise. Let's get him, take him back to the embassy, hand him over, get him charged with murder, so and so and so and so. And Hall's gone, the man must be executed, he's committing. And Sammy, he just cracked. Can you see that? I mean, he leapt over a wall. I mean, he just went for it. And the firing squad dropped him, And Mick Wainwright went and shot him in the head. And, as I say, the whole thing was insanity.
You've got a firing squad lined up.
Yeah.
You've told the bloke straight he's going to get shot.
Yeah.
Executed.
Yeah.
You, Hall.
Yeah.
Holden Roberto.
Go out.
And where's Wainwright in this then?
Wainwright was just standing at the side with the firing squad.
Holden Roberto is then saying, let's go back and...
And this is all done in front of Sammy.
How far were you away from the firing squad?
We were standing next to them, and this is the thing, they were...
How far away was... Copeland?
Sammy was within earshot of it, can you see that? Mm.
And he legs it?
Aye, he says, I'm going to live, I'm going to die. And, he just couldn't take anymore,
no,
I mean...
Of course. How long was the conversation go on for?
It went on for a couple of minutes, you could see him, he was hyperventilating. And, I'm saying, make up your mind, what do you want to do? You can't, And Sammy bolted and the firing squad got him.
How long did it take? How many paces did he take before he was shot?
He just sort of cleared the wall that was next to him. Because we were going to,
put him against
him. Yeah. And he leapt over the wall and he went down at the wall. And unfortunately, Mick Wainwright ran out and shot him in the head,
Yeah.
Because he'd caught about 3 or 4 rounds,
Well, that must have been somewhat of a...
Yeah.
A shattering experience.
No, we came in and anyway, I then got
what happened after that silence?
Just pure silence. I says, right, okay. I says, let's get this together. I said, I looked at the men, I says, these men are no good. Mm. I said to Holden Roberto, these men are incapable of fighting. I says, let me...
What was their attitude after they'd shot this bloke? Were they I know there was silence, but there was cheering?
No, there wasn't any cheering. No, there wasn't. I think it was just some form of relief in that, Callan had these guys terrorised. If you stepped out of line, they'd just blow you away. Mm. And it was just sheer terror, it's the type of thing you have when discipline breaks down, it's like the Russian front. If you don't carry out your task, you're shot. That type of discipline. And I then said to, as I say, I said to Holden Roberto, these men are no good. And I just went, who wants to go home? And a lot of them says, yeah. What? And I got the normal bullshit. I need a bit of a rest. I says, you've only been out here 2 weeks, mate.
Mm.
They all wanted to fly back for a bit of R&R. I says, you either go or you stay. The people who want to stay and do the business, stay there. And the people that want to go home, stay there.
Mm.
And my cousin turned around and he says, I need a wee bit of rest and I've got to go back and put Margaret's mind at ease. And one guy was going to go away and bring back 90 more men, all sorts of things.
Mm.
And I was left with soldiers from World War II and guys who'd never been in the army. And it was...
How the... How were the ones from World War II coping? Or
well, an actual fact, they were terrific. You know, to some of them it was like sort of being reborn, you know. So the first thing I said is, I says, where's the tanks? They says they're 12 mile down the road. And I looked around, I'm sitting there with, you know, all Callan's black troops had deserted, they'd cleared off.
Mm.
And I'm sitting there with 22 men. There's a Cuban column coming up the road. I says, right, get in the trucks, pull back to San Salvador.
Mm.
So we pulled back to San Salvador, and I collected what guys was left in that town.
Mm.
And I says, right, we'll make a stand here. So I actually took the guys out, and I started making, you know, giving each, putting each company in various places. And lo and behold, Callan's special train company had turned up. They'd all gapped it from McKellar. So I says, I'll have a try with these people and see if, you know...
Where had they been lurking then, or...?
They ran away from Callan and turned up at San Salvador.
Okay.
This was his special shop company, you know.
And they were who? They were...
Angolans.
Angolans.
So I've left Brummie with about 800 men. In San Salvador, we had about 100... 100, maybe 200 black troops. And then by this time a third batch of whites came out. So I got them, I explained the situation to them, and some Americans had turned up, and we started training the guys, you know, get out your positions. And and the next thing was, is the CIA guys came to see me again, and they said, Peter, you know, can you do anything for us? I says, what do you mean? I says, look, I said, I can retake Tomboko. You know, but you've got to let me have the kit.
Mm.
You know, you can't ask me, you know, that I've got no petrol. You know, I've got to have enough petrol to get me to Tomboko. If I can't take the turn, I'm going to have enough to get me back here. And if I lose anything in the way, and I put in, I multiplied everything by three. And without realising, I was getting forced into some form of staff work, you know. And he says, right. So I says, right, tomorrow morning, I want five flights a day shipping stuff in here with a fork of friendship. Say the first flight being loaded in the dark at Kinshasa, arriving here for first flight, good. 11 o'clock, I'm still waiting on the airplane coming in. Because now the fork of friendship had taken the guys back from McKellar, plus Nick Hall, and plus the guys that wanted to go home. So she comes in about 11 o'clock, the Fokker, and those five drums of fuel on it. I says, where's this fuel I need? You know, the guy says, Nick Hall was in the casino till 5 o'clock this morning. You know, he arrived and told us to bring these five. You know, so I says, right, I got in the Fokker, and I flew up to, you know, by this time I know that the Gooks are still up at McKellar. I flew into Kinshasa and I walked into Holden Roberto. I says to him, I says, you have got to get rid of that man.
Mm.
You know, you've got to get rid of this man and put somebody that's going to back me up. If he's going to handle logistics there, let him do so. I says, but you know, he's got to, you know, I told you I wanted five flights a day. You're asking me to retake a town, I can't take it.
Mm.
So I got in the aircraft and I flew back down with another load of stuff. No, stop. I met this American pilot called Dave Bufkin, and I said, I'm trying to get back down to San Salvador. He says, there's an impounded Angolan Airways aeroplane on the runway in Dili. He says, if we can get that, we'll get back down to Angola.
Mm.
I says, good. So I got a load of money, and I walked up to Dili Airport, and we were dressed in camouflage, carrying weapons, and guy came to the door, I says, there's some money. I says, can you let us in? He says, certainly. We went up to the aircraft, the key was in it, checked out, we need some fuel, called a fuel, give me some fuel, there's some money. Just the wheel up. And we just got straight onto the runway, went, wow, took off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no radio traffic, nothing. And we had a Shell roadmap. So we're flying down to Angola, and Mike Bufkin saying to me, where do we go next? I'm saying, take the next turning on the left. You know what? We use a roadmap. I got back down there. And I noticed as we landed that there was an awful absence of civilians in the town.
Yeah.
I says, this doesn't look right. So I get down, I says, everything okay? I says to Mike Bufkin, Mike, I want to do a recce. He says, come on. So we flew out in a recce. And we flew along the road, and then I seen something move. I says, Mike, there's something over there. And you could see the track. And then what they had was, they had vehicles with sort of cage over them. I could see two wee rockets on them. And they just pulled into the side of the road and the aircraft came in. And there was a bit of ground fire came up. And I says, Mike, I think we're in trouble here. And I went along and I counted 72 armoured vehicles. And then the end of the column was just a mass of pantechnicons, you know. Mm-hmm. Articulated vehicles full of troops. So I got back to San Salvador. And the guys were there and I says, right, put up your hands, everybody wants to fight. So they're sort of putting their hands up like that. And I says, well, there's 72 armoured vehicles on the way here. So I got a message to meet the CIA that night at a place called Lucoso, The crossroads there. So they'd crossed over from Zaire to meet me. So I drove up and they had a chat to me. And he says, Peter, pull out. I says, why? He says, everything's, the rug's been pulled out. There's nothing more coming in here. Congress has heard about the massacre. You know, we can't seem to be back in this type of thing. So we're going to have to call it quits. He says, and if you fight, you're fighting on pride. You know, he says, there's nothing you're going to lose. I says, what do you advise? He says, pull back to here and cross the border tomorrow night. And I was lucky. Because what happened is, you had a road running north to south. And although the Cubans were coming from Makela to get into San Salvador, you come up around the side of a hill. Right, so in actual fact, you cut off the road to San Salvador. Can you see that? To come into it. And because San Salvador was at the top of a sort of plateau. So at Lucoso Crossroads, there was also a bridge up there. And what unbeknown to me at the time was the Cubans were coming along another road. In actual fact, they were closing the pincer, although not actually connecting together. They had to have gone like that to connect up. But I didn't notice, and I said, right, we had a bridge prepared for demolition. So I said to this chap called Dan Aiken, I says, get yourself across there and blow that bridge. They blew the bridge, and when they blew that bridge, the Cubans were only 1,000 yards off it. So we managed to pull into Lucoso Crossroads, and the CIA came across that night, and I says, what's the form? You know, I said, Peter, it's over. Now, I'd also sent a patrol out. Now, John Namak had arrived there by then.
Yeah.
John Namak had gone out on a patrol. The patrol hadn't returned. And, you know, I was wondering why it hadn't returned. And they ran into an ambush. But I didn't know this. So I says, okay. Right. So I then got the guys over the border that night.
How far were you away from the guys when you were meeting the CIA?
My chaps.
Yeah. What I'm saying is, how difficult was it to get them out?
No, there was no problem. It was just over the border.
Right. So how far were you all away from the border?
22 kilometres.
22 kilometres.
Aye, there was only 22 kilometres of ground.
Right.
And by this time, three quarters of my men were deployed. There was the FNLA army had gone off its head. They were raping, pillaging, you know, robbing each other. It was, you know, discipline was completely broken. And I didn't have enough men to control it. And I just looked at the situation.
So what happened to that plane, incidentally?
Right, I got the guys over the border. Me and Mike Bufkin stayed. Once the guys were over, we flew up to Kinshasa. I then walked in, and Nick Hall's there. Of course, Hall's back in uniform again, back in favour. Why have you given up the town? Why have you given up the ground? I said, well, I never saw you down there. Can you see that? I said, I never saw you in Angola. The whole time I've been there, you've suddenly appointed yourself as a military supremo, you know, and the only time I see you in a uniform, and a uniform is when you want somebody court-martialed. I says, in this case, it might be me now. I says, but you know, I've gone on the advice of somebody else. Anyway, I got on the plane the next day, and we flew back down to Angola. and I flew over the area with John Namock and them had gone out on patrol. And I was trying to contact him on the radio.
John Namock personally?
No, his patrol.
His patrol.
And there was no contact.
No.
And I flew back out. I met the CIA that night.
So were these the same guys?
Same guys. And then they says, look, we've got an awful lot of radio traffic going on just now. We'll see you over the next couple of days. So I went over to the house that they had the next day, you know, and there was a meal laid on for me, and they started talking. They says, look, you know, we've got to get into a covert phase here. Congress, we cannot be seen to be aiding the FNLA overtly. And they said, you know, we're going to go through a training phase, and they wanted to start raiding back in to tie the MPLA down. And I says, how many of your guys can do it? I said, I don't think any of them are capable of it. I say, it takes a special type of man to do that. And, you know, I says, you know, it's over. So they asked me to stay on. And what happened is I shipped all the guys out back home. And Holden Roberto came to see me. And I says, look, you know, I'm prepared to stay. You know, I'll carry on. There's me and a guy called Dan Aiken. And eventually he came and says, there's nothing to be gained. He paid me off and I came home.
So how long did that...
The whole thing
from January till...
I came home in the beginning of April.
The next year?
No, that year. Same year.
So only that only 4 months, 3 months?
The whole thing only took 3 months.
Good Lord.
Yeah. I mean, it was... You know, as I say, I look back at it now, and it was total insanity.
Yeah.
And, you know, what it has made me aware of, unless you can get staff, train people in there to keep the whole control on the situation, supply the situation, and above all, coordinate it. Because all you had was three groups here making pinpricks at a Russian-trained army.
Yeah.
When I look back at it now, in hindsight, I don't think I could have altered the outcome of the war. I could have just slowed it down. Can you see that?
Yeah. At the stage you entered it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Too much damage had been done by then, and the other thing was is, you know, the selection of the people you got doing the job. It takes a certain type of man, and because a man is a good professional soldier and a good career soldier, doesn't necessarily make him a good mercenary. You know, it's chalk and cheese. You know.
What? How did Holden Roberto strike you? I mean, how could you describe him? What sort of impression did he make?
He was a man who wanted something. He wanted it badly. But was probably no better than the other African leaders who he was fighting against. You know, they were all tarred with the same brush.
Yeah. But he was very fickle on whether this bloke should be shot or not.
Yeah, you know, I don't think he was a decisive man, but, you know, not every president gets himself into that position, you know.
Yeah. What age was he then?
I think he was in his early 40s.
Really?
Early mid-40s, yeah.
Mid-40s. And what background was he, a lawyer or something? Or?
I think he could be right there being a lawyer. And he formed an organisation called GRAY, the Army Revolution, you know, Angola. And him and Savimbi were in together, and then Savimbi broke away and formed UNITA.
UNITA.
And because they were fighting against the Portuguese then. Do you see that?
Ah.
See, the revolution groups had been fighting against the Portuguese. The Portuguese Empire collapsed, and then it was open season. They just said, we're pulling out. And just pulled out and left a power vacuum. That's where the fighting started.
Right.
Eventually, they all agreed to share power.
But.
But, and then, you know.
Yeah. What happened to Callan?
Callan was actually captured. There was, I think it was eight of them captured, and they were given various sentences. 12 of them captured. I can't remember the actual figure. Four were executed, and the rest were given various sentences. The Americans were all released early. And the Brits were released about 18 months after them.
That wasn't the same batch as John Namak, was it?
That was the same batch.
Oh, it was the same, okay.
They were all there, they all get done together. I think John gets 16 years, and the sentences varied from 15 years up until 30.
Yeah.
But the Americans, John, I think John done about 8.5, 8 years.
Oh, I think, 85, I think he got out, or 84. It must have been 84.
84, yeah.
So 76, 77 to 84.
Yeah.
Callan was shot.
He was executed, yeah.
He was executed with the others.
Yeah.
Including the one that was injured, wasn't it?
Yeah, there was a guy called Mackenzie who'd been on the massacre.
Right, which was Callan. The next question, yeah.
Bromley Barker, who was executed, he was an Irishman. He was caught at San Salvador. And one American, Daniel Gerhardt. And that poor idiot, he had a card in his wallet from the Soldier of Fortune magazine. You know, and it says, you came out here to fight. You were a mercenary beforehand. You know?
Yeah.
And the guy that came across there as a scumbag, according to John Namak, was Grillo. Grillo went, you know, he was just a poor Latin immigrant, you know, who was putty in the hands of the American capitalist, you know? You know, forced to go and fight in Vietnam, you know? And he really played to the communist tune. I mean, he went off to Cuba and everything, you know?
Really?
Aye.
What happened to him in the end?
Went back to America. But those American guys have been fairly quiet. They haven't gobbled off too much, you know.
The Americans were released about 18 months before John Namak and Co. Who was the one who was wounded and
executed? Mackenzie.
Right, and he took part in one of the massacres.
Yeah, yeah.
What happened to the third person who took part in the massacre?
He came back to this country. Now, his name slips me at the moment, but I know the chap. He actually said he'd switched his gas down. Everybody had stoppages except Sammy Copeland, because Sammy Copeland had been executed. Can you see that?
Yeah.
And, you know, they had gas stoppages, and he switched his gas down so they get a stoppage, you know?
Yeah.
His name eludes me at the moment.
Is he, is he in circulation or not?
Yes, he is, yeah.
Really, people know where he is, or?
Mm.
Yeah. What about the press coverage? You've got the press coverage of the mercenaries being selected.
Yeah.
And as far as I can recall, you know, they got the TV cameras, were at the hotel, and it was late. The flights were either late at night or early in the morning or something or other, and they were, the press were there.
Yeah.
And then either they stopped or they were banned or something.
They were actually stopped from going.
By the police or by the
government, I think.
By the government.
By the authorities. And you know the...
Hold it. All right. I thought for a second this was going... We're okay.
Yeah. It was unfortunate, and the whole thing just got out of control, and they were, in actual fact, for them to be any good, they were actually brought in too late. And the other thing is, there was no training phase. Guys got off a truck, and you know, there was no shakedown, no who's good at what or who can do what, and who's got leadership, who hasn't got leadership. Mm. Everybody was just thrown in the deep end. It was insanity.
What There was the first the publicity about the massacres and Callan.
Yeah.
And the truck was pictured and all the rest of it. I don't know where they got the pictures from.
Yeah, no, they got pictures of a truck. That was Callan's truck with a machine gun on it.
Yeah.
There was some pictures.
As far as I can recall, there was a Bedford with a machine gun on it.
No, it wasn't. Callan's actual truck was I think it was either a Toyota or a Land Rover.
Was it really? Okay. And there was that sort of, that was in all the papers.
Yeah.
And then there was over the blokes who were captured. First there was the capture, and then there was the trial, but actually there was less publicity over the trial.
Yeah.
What news were you getting fed back from England when you were...
To be honest with you, I get back here. And it was extremely heavy on my nervous system. You know, I was getting phone calls. What happened is John Banks just went to ground. If you want to know anything about your son's phone, Peter McAleese. You know, and I tried to clean up the situation.
Really?
I stayed behind with the embassy, trying to find out who was where.
I was just gonna, my train of thought. I was going to ask you, what was the relation... What was the relationship with Banks? Was that with Holden Roberto, or was that with CIA?
No. You know, the papers ran an awful lot into it. Holden Roberto was given money by the CIA.
Mm.
You know, they'd, and he used that money to recruit. There was no CIA involvement
with
in
Banks.
Recruiting with Banks.
No.
That was rubbish.
Yeah. Okay. What happened to the... what did you do immediately? Okay, Holden Roberto said it's all over. So
yeah.
What did you do then?
I spoke to the Americans and they asked me to become involved with them in a retraining phase.
Oh, yes.
So for
covert
I agreed. And I hung around and I just says, you know, it's not getting them back in. You may as well go. And I come home.
You said you stayed with the embassy.
No, I went to the embassy and I was trying to help them to piece all the names together because there was no Norman.
That was in Kinshasa,
yeah.
Right. What was their attitude towards you?
I really don't know. You know, all
it's
I,
very blank,
I,
was it?
Oh. No, all I know is that they were trying to piece something together and I was the only person that could help them.
Yeah.
So they probably needed me and tolerated me because they needed me.
Yeah.
And as I say, I flew back here.
One question I forgot to ask was, at that time,
yeah,
I was speaking to, at that time,
why?
A friend of mine, a colleague of mine, was talking about half frame 35mm pictures were taken. And he seemed, and he had to develop them. He was working in this country, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
And he, at that time, was thought that the only half-frame 35mm cameras that were used were, if I may put it that way, in official hands.
I never saw a camera the whole time, because I didn't allow photographs to get taken. And... since then, some stuff has come to surface, yeah.
So you really didn't know all that much about it?
No, I didn't.
No. Okay. So when did you go back to England? You said it had screwed up your nervous system or something.
No, I felt I was exhausted.
Yeah, sure.
And I got back here, and there were people phoning, you know, women. There's an old woman from Kettering, worried about her son, Fortune, you know, Satch Fortune. My son's dead, you know, And Shotgun Charlie's father phoned up, you know, do you know what happened? And I says, I better go and put all these people right, you know. And I drove round trying to put their minds at ease. And in the process, I was driving myself round the bend, because, you know, you know, what was actually hurting me was the heartache it had been caused by the husbands, the sons. Can you see that? They were playing a big boys game, but they didn't realise what they were leaving behind. And... I came out of one house there and I just said, I'm not taking any more of this. And I went away up to Scotland and stayed up there for a few weeks. You know.
Where were you staying? Where had you been staying in England at that time?
In Hereford. Yeah.
In Hereford.
Yeah.
And were you still receiving any cash to do this? Or
No, I did it all off my own bike.
Did you receive any reasonable amount of cash out of it?
I cleared out the whole thing about just over £1,000.
Really?
Yeah.
Which, in those days even.
Yeah.
Well, certainly for the work you'd done. What do you do after that then?
I came out.
I think it's 76 to 80,
yeah.
You're talking about Rhodesia.
Yeah. So in 76, I went to work on, and back on the oil rigs.
Right.
And got a job on one of the platforms. And I came back for 2 weeks leave and I met a chap from Rhodesia called Chuck Hind. He'd been in the British SAS with me. And I says, Chuck, you know, what's actually going on there? He says, well, if you can get yourself out there, you'll get into the army. So I says, yeah. So this was in September, October, I met Chuck. And come December, I felt life closing in on me again, you know. So I said, I'm going to go to Rhodesia. So on the 31st of December 1976, I flew out to Rhodesia to join the Rhodesian Army. I booked into a place called the Ambassador Hotel, and I went to the recruiting office and said, no, we don't, you know, they said, what have you been doing? I said, I've been in Angola. They said, we don't take mercenaries here. I said, yeah. So I went to see Chuck Hind, and Chuck Hind knew an ex-parachute regiment officer there called Dudley Coventry, a very famous man.
Okay.
And Dudley sent a chap down to see me called Jack Berry, who spoke to me. And he says, okay.
So you're in Salisbury?
In Salisbury, in Rhodesia. Yeah.
Well, how much did it cost? A lot of money to get out there?
I borrowed it off a friend of mine called Murray Davis. It was nearly £300.
Yeah.
And I arrived, as I say, I booked in the Ambassador, contacted Chuck Hind, who put me in, who spoke to Dudley Coventry, and a guy called Jack Berry came to see me. And Jack said, you know, okay, go and join the army, you're in. I went down there, signed all the papers, sent me up to Cranbourne Barracks, and
on the outskirts of...
On the outskirts of Salisbury. Mm. And I'm expecting it to be like the British SAS, you know, everybody...